The way I see it, Ikigai is a body and mind experience that occurs when participants reflect on it and connect it with certain aspects of their lives. The body is both a natural pre-reflective self and an important medium for reflexivity. Therefore, thinking, perceiving, imagining, and feeling Ikigai experience are all parts of body knowledge. If we are to study phenomena like Ikigai and its experience, we need to place the body at its center because this experience comes from people's perceptions, orientation, and engagement with the world and requires body knowledge to embody and make sense of itself and its interrelated dimensions.
This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast. Japanese wisdom for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Find your Ikigai at ikigaitribe.com. My guest today on episode 56 is Jamila Rodriguez, an anthropologist focused on well-being and crisis management. Jamila, you completed your PhD in dance anthropology and Sufism embodied ritual practice at Roehampton University in London in 2017. You worked as a professional dancer in the UK, South Africa, and many other countries for 12 years. And as I just mentioned, you have traveled to many countries, previously as a professional dancer and later on as a visiting lecturer or research fellow. In 2022, you were awarded the Japan Society for the Promotion of Science Fellowship, hosted by the International Research Center for Japanese Studies in Kyoto. You are also a visiting researcher at the Marine Climate Change Unit in Okinawa at the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology. You have written on fields such as interdisciplinarity, on Japanese marine scientists, social scientists' ideas, and experiences about collaborative work. You're also developing a study with marine scientists, a pilot project that investigates Okinawan fishery community ideas and experiences regarding climate change, its social-cultural impact, and its impact on the well-being of communities and coastal areas. And you're also fortunate enough to be living in Okinawa. Your current research is on embodied Ikigai, Japanese women's narratives on well-being in times of crisis. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you for the generous introduction and long introduction.
Yeah, got a bit tongue-tied there and I'm a bit flustered because of what's been going on outside. But it really is a joy to have you and that we connected. And
thank
I
you.
Reached out to you because I found this wonderful YouTube video and it was titled Finding Ikigai During Times of Crisis. And I thought, Oh, I've got to watch this. And so I watched it. And I thought, I really need to reach out to you. So you were kind enough to reply. We had a good chat last week. And you have written two papers on the subject of Ikigai. And we're going to discuss one of them today, Embodied Ikigai, Life Meaning Through the Body. So first, we talked about this and I thought, this actually is a good question. So Jamila, you are probably the first guest who I know suffered a significant loss of Ikigai. So would you like to share what that was?
Yeah, well, I was working as a professional dancer and I had a car accident in Namibia a couple of years ago and was quite serious. He almost killed me and I was quite debilitated afterwards. I was unable to dance. I was unable to go back to my professional practice. I was left with mobility issues, visual issues, a lot of complications, which now after the years, things got better and I'm back to being mobile again. But at the time, obviously being a professional dancer, and when doctors tell you not be able to dance anymore, you don't know what Ikigai, well, I didn't know what Ikigai was at that time, but a lot of people told me, Jamila, you need to find another purpose of life, mission of life, you know, another ikigai, in other words. So I do think at that time, I lost my ikigai. I lost my sense of self, who I was. You know, I lost my profession and my identity. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. Not only was your profession, but this creative expression of who you are. And I'm sure it was something you really enjoyed, but I'm sure it was also challenging, and you had to be fit and train and practice. And then I guess in a horrible instant, you lost all of that and you had to, yeah, think about how do I move forward. So I've never really met someone or interviewed someone who's had that experience, but clearly it looks like you have a lot of ikigai in your life. So we'll talk about that. But as you mentioned, you didn't know at the time about the word ikigai, but obviously you did stumble upon the word. So when did you stumble upon the word ikigai?
So I first stumbled on the word ikigai when I was working on an international research project about the lived experience of the pandemic. So I was at OIST, Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology in Okinawa, and I worked with a team of scholars and experts in different fields, anthropology, psychiatry, philosophy, and so on. The survey that this team created at the Embodied Cognitive Science reached out to over 2,600 people. And around 500, if I'm not mistaken, 500 people were Japanese. So 500 participants were Japanese. So the survey asked a lot of things, and things that the survey asked was, how are you coping with the pandemic? What are the things that you are missing and how are you coping with it? So I began to read people's answers, and I noticed a pattern that people across the world, culturally speaking, had different ways of coping. So whereby I was quite interested to see difference of patterns of coping between the UK and Japan, because I lived in both countries. Mm-hmm. So I lived in the UK before and I was living in Japan. Then I came to realize that a lot of people in the UK were coping with, and they would mention things such as listening to podcasts and reading self-help books and doing yoga and phoning their families and walking the dog and reading books and returning to activities that they left it behind. Then I noticed a different pattern in the Japanese answers, although, you know, obviously there are commonalities. But then I realized that a lot of the participants in Japan started to talk about connecting with nature, the importance of family, so to cook for the family, to keep their family healthy. There was an extreme economic worry. So a lot of the Japanese participants were quite worried with their jobs, with the security of their jobs, but also about keeping their sense of mission or well-being. And they kept referring this thing of giving back to society, doing things for the others. So I was curious, and I began to investigate in cultural ways of well-being. And then the word ikigai came up as, you know, a cultural way of well-being. And that's how I, you know, stumbled across the word.
There you go. So really, research and having this experience of living in Japan. And it is interesting how the word isn't really mentioned that much in daily conversation. I think we often hear the word yarigai, and that's, you know, worth doing. And this is how I think I found you. I think I was thinking that there must be a study on the impact of the pandemic on ikigai, and I'm quite certain there'll be many papers written about it. And that loss of ikigai for people and how they either maybe replaced their loss of ikigai with maybe a short-term alternative, or how they struggled. I remember one friend who's single, he's in his mid-50s, and his ikigai is just going out a lot and having dinner with the boys, and he's like a social butterfly. And he's always been a very calm, considerate, level-headed person. And I record one phone call, and I think we were 6 months in, and he was just angry at the pandemic and at our government for the shutdowns. And I'd never seen him like that. And on reflection, I think he was like that because he'd lost this important source of social ikigai. So, yeah, it's interesting how the pandemic has been this collective experience. And obviously many people lost their ikigai source and struggled. And so we'll move on to this really interesting question. And one even I struggle to define. And that's, how would you define ikigai after all these interviews and all this research you've done? I think it's quite a hard question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has their own definitions. And I think we might all come down to the same answer potentially. But because it's so difficult to define, and as I told you before, I'm going to use another word, which is also a cultural word. So in Portuguese and also in the Creole language, we have the word saudade. Now, saudade, it's a word that can be defined as a kind of nostalgic feeling caused by distance, or by something or by someone, an absence of a person, you know, when someone dies, or an absence of not being in a place, or the desire of going to certain experiences, situations. But there's no concrete real definition of this word saudade, because it's really rooted in the Portuguese language. And Mozambique people, Cape Verde, Brazilians, all Portuguese-speaking cultures, they understand the word, but we can't really translate. And I was talking to another colleague of mine, Igor de Almeida. He works at Kyoto University, and we were talking about this, you know, ikigai idea, and he was the one who said to me, well, it's a little bit like saudade, isn't it? So it's a concept that it's culturally rooted. Everyone knows, but no one speaks about it. So if you ask me what saudade is, you know, I just gave you the explanation, but there's no concrete, because it's something that I feel it.
Yeah.
So ikigai in that sense might be, you know, a way of life, a sense of mission, a sense of life meaning, but it can also just be general well-being, right? Or about the things that you want to do, or that you envision to do, or that you like to do. My idea as a dancer and working on body studies and embodiment is that, just as saudade, I feel it in my body, I feel that ikigai is also a corporeal feeling. So it's a bodily sensation. And I understood that also, not just because I had these, you know, hypotheses, but also doing field work with my participants and finding out about their ideas of ikigai and how were they expressing ikigai.
There you go. I think you just proved how complex it is, and how in some case I guess if we're fortunate enough to learn and speak maybe multiple languages, we might come across similar words. And that saudade, is that right?
Yeah, saudade. Yeah.
That actually sounds very similar to the word natsukashi, that idea of
The longing of something.
Nostalgia and longing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a component of ikigai, that even memories can be a source of ikigai for some people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I first went to Japan and when I started going out with friends, I would occasionally hear this word natsukashi, and I, as you know, Japanese often just speak in verbs or adjectives, and I was trying to work out what does this word mean. And we don't say something like, "Oh, how nostalgic." We would have to say, "Oh, that candy. I love that candy. I used to eat that candy in my childhood."
Yeah, you
but
need
Japanese
a long.
Could, yeah, Japanese yeah. can work it out from context. And that's the fascinating thing about, I guess, languages, and for me, Japanese. So it is a complex concept, but it's something, I guess, quite intuitive. Obviously, for Japanese, they just grow up with it. So it's fascinating. And then your article introduced me to, a concept or idea, or this going on beyond emotionally feeling ikigai. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. So your article, Embodied Ikigai, Life Meaning Through the Body, focuses on ikigai and its embodiment experience. And this really, resonated with me. Ikigai is definitely something you feel. And as I mentioned, I tended to focus on emotions and feelings inspired by the work of Miyako Kamiya, who was Japan's research pioneer. But I really appreciated and liked how you focused on how it feels to the body, and it has got me thinking. So before we dive into your paper, do you think your embodied approach was influenced by your experience of dancing for so many years?
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. I mean, and I mentioned that in my article, right? I think in my former days as a dancer, my body was my laboratory, right? It was my laboratory. So I discovered the world through my body. I discovered about, you know, time and rhythm and perception of the self in relation to space and to others and dynamics, you know, relationships, boundaries, and so on, right? So for me, although I'm not dancing anymore, this way of engaging with the world still continues. I still pretty much live on an embodied, you know, way of living the world. So I think about Ikigai as embodied experience, as a feeling of attending to and with the body when you're living this mission. So an embodied approach, for me, it seemed ideal because I want to manifest my sense of purpose in life through my body. You know, I recognize my life mission when I feel a certain suspension in my body, and my body gives me the knowledge that I need to navigate the world.
Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com. Now back to the episode. I agree, and that there are moments when your body seems to be telling you something, especially the gut, which is often described as the second brain or the second mind. And yeah, at moments you'll get, if you're nervous, you'll feel it maybe in your gut or all over your body, or even the body seems to warn you that maybe there's impending danger or you need to be careful. And so I guess for someone who's, yeah, as a dancer, probably you're far more in tune to the way the body communicates than most people. And I guess people who don't exercise and don't look after their bodies, it probably results in that poor body-mind communication. So, yeah, I imagine as someone who danced for so long and worked with their body, you'd be really connected to it and in tune and have this almost closer, more intimate connection to your body, which kind of sounds strange, but I think, yeah, our body does communicate to us.
Yeah, I think, I mean, your body is part of your identity, right? Mm. I mean, our bodies are our business cards in a sense, the way we present ourselves to the world. You can't, you know, look at a person and say, oh, what an attractive mind, but you say, oh, what an attractive body. So in that sense, the body speaks before we speak, right? Before the mind speaks, before you can show off your personality traits and, you know, your ideas and share your thoughts and reveal other parts of yourself. The first part that comes about yourself, it is your body.
That is true. And I guess that's why millions or billions of people are very much fixated on their beauty.
On body image, yes.
Body image, yeah.
Which then creates a problem. Yeah, exactly. Which then, you know, creates massive challenges, especially between, you know, young generations and not just across young generations. I think, you know, I'm not talking about an obsession of the body. So when I say that our bodies are our business cards, I'm not telling you that we all have to, you know, follow social media and become the pursuit of gorgeousness. But, you know, but in the sense that, you know, we are physical matter and physical matter matters, right?
Yeah, this really is interesting. So I never really considered this perspective. And You argue that an embodied perspective of Ikigai is essential to studies on well-being, life meaning, or general human behavior. So would you like to expand on that?
I mean, we spoke about embodiment, right? And I don't know who's listening to the podcast. So let me just unpack what I mean with embodiment first. I see embodiment defined as how we experience the world. And I said that before, right? So how we experience the world and the interconnections between sensory, cognitive, emotional, and corporeal dimensions. So I like to think that the body provides us with embodied ways of knowing ourselves and knowing our surroundings. These as not as minds detached from our bodies, but as cohesive human beings. So when I started to think about Ikigai and the phenomenon of Ikigai and this lived experience, then I thought about, well, if Ikigai is also, you know, a general way of well-being, of, you know, flourishing in life, then we need to place the body at the center, because our well-being comes from our subjective perceptions and orientations and values and engagement with the world. And that requires body knowledge to embody and make sense of itself. And these, you know, interrelated dimensions of cognition and emotions and sensations and, you know, muscles and nerves and gut, as you explain. So it's all interconnected, right?
Yes, it is. And I'm now surprised why hasn't this been explored? I don't think I've found a paper like yours before, or I haven't. So, yeah, this really has opened the door wider on the Ikigai world for me. So thank you for doing the research. It's always a real joy to, I mean, as you probably know, one of my Ikigai is researching Ikigai. And so when I learn, I love to learn. So I've learned so much from this paper and our discussion.
I'm glad you like it.
So I'm looking forward to your second paper too. So, yeah, so let's touch on your paper. You state that Ikigai should be studied as both a somatic and embodied process. And, yeah, I'll be honest here. This is why I stumble upon these words that I don't really fully understand. That would be somatic. So these words are related to experiences of the body. But, yeah, how is somatic and maybe embodied process, how are these two terms different?
Okay, so somatic experience is a sort of like alternative therapy. And usually somatic practitioners work with treating patients or people with certain traumas or certain, you know, stress-related disorders. And somatic experiences or somatic practices can be anything that, you know, relates to body and mind. So I would say yoga therapy could be a somatic process.
I see.
Walking meditation can be a somatic process. So something, a somatic experience that comes from the somatic process, right? So it's this awareness of your body and mind as one, as soma. So meditation does that a lot, right? So when you have these, you know, your mind is not detached from your body, although you might have the sensation of detachment, right? The sensation of being not in the body. But that sensation of not being in the body happens through the body. So it's paradoxical, right? When you tell me, well, I had a sensation that I'm outside of my body, you can recall back that sensation as a sensation of not being in the body. So it's a bit paradoxical. And the somatic practice happens with that. So I think when I started to walk again after the car accident, I decided to do walking meditation because I needed to retrain, you know, my feet, and I needed to retrain having the sensation of having the weight of my body on earth, literally, because I couldn't before. So I call that a somatic practice, you know, the awareness of where your feet are in relation to the floor and the elements that were around me. So I was in a forest and I had dogs, and there are days that, you know, you walk, you know, obviously you walk in absolute silence. So you might experience the sun, or you might experience wind, or you might experience rain, and you don't overanalyze these sensations, but you let them happen. And the somatic process, you know, it's kind of related to that, this way of letting go with no analyzing and just feel what happens now. And I wanted to explore that feeling of what happens, of ikigai, if that makes any sense. So then I developed a framework to study ikigai as embodiment. And that framework, again, doesn't come just from my hypothesis, but it comes from the interviews that I've done with my participants. This isn't just an idea of my participants, but I think, for example, that ikigai embodiment experience relates to the sense of self, to the interaction with the environment, with people, relationships with others, sometimes calls for reflection, for perception. Sometimes it's about imagination, how you imagine ikigai. So, I mean, we can talk about it further and I can explain a little bit more in detail.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, we should mention at the time of the podcast, your papers are in submission.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how long or what's involved, but when the paper is published, I'll put it in the podcast notes along with the image of your framework.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Because frameworks are very helpful that you have this visual representation of a theory or concept. And I loved all these elements you brought together. So, yeah, let's go into a bit more detail.
Yeah, so the framework that I developed, so we have, you know, several interdimensions. And as you can see on the framework, they're not separated. So they always overlap. So they're always interrelated. So I call one of them the self, as I explained. So an example, what do I mean with self? Well, awareness of identity. You know, through ikigai, you have a sense of who you are.
Absolutely.
The other one, I call it others, which means, you know, family, friends. So the relationship of the self in relation to other. And I think Matthew Gordon touches on this quite a lot.
Yeah, and that made me think about also Miyako Kami's need of resonance.
Absolutely.
Like social affiliation. Yeah, so that's definitely important to ikigai. Yeah.
And Isa, you know, in her anthropological work with elderly communities in Osaka, she also touches that a lot. Then the ecological, connecting with nature. How important, you know, for my participants were the connection with nature and how they find ikigai through nature. And that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, that surprised me too. And then I thought, well, that makes sense because so many times people have told me it might not be their number one ikigai source, but they always seem to mention, you know, connecting with nature, going out walking or surfing or mountain climbing. So it seems to be something everyone appreciates and it gives their life meaning and that sense of awe and sense of small self, I think, when you go out in nature.
And sense of connection.
Maybe it ties into resonance, that's not just your social world, but feeling connected to the environmental world.
Then obviously the mental state. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when people think about their sources of ikigai or what makes them have ikigai, they become calmer. So a sense, you know, it can bring you to a kind of mental state, which is beneficial, right? It's cognitive, how you perceive these inner changes. Again, you know, this idea of just asking someone, what is your ikigai? You're already on a cognitive level, right? You are needing to verbalize a concept that is so intrinsic and you have to verbalize it. So you really need to reflect back and, you know, think about it, reflecting on it. And culture and social. So culture as in finding specific symbols or values for themselves or words, you know, like I explained in my article that sometimes, you know, people say that to cope with crisis, they have to ishokemen. So they have to, you know, work hard and keep going and enduring. And as you say, you know, like words like natsukashi and ikigai, they are cultural words. They are symbols to things that in other, potentially other cultures, they use it differently or they don't have the words to express that. And then social. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, Japan is that culture of that set expressions.
Mm.
We often hear just the same expressions, you know, ganbaru or gaman.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember working in a restaurant, and it became so easy to work there because there was these handfuls of expressions I could use. And, you know, irashimase and hai yorokonde. And so Japan is unique.
Yeah.
It has that these set expressions or words that all Japanese tend to say. And I don't think we have them to, certainly not to the same degree in English. And I've mentioned this before in a podcast. I've tried to think about, is there one word in Australia that's culturally unique, hard to define, tied to a collective identity, but also maybe individual, have a social context and, yeah, important. And the sort of the only word is mateship.
Mm.
And that ties to our contribution to World War One, and it has all these elements, so it's multidimensional. And we have that expression also, g'day mate. So we do value mateship, but it goes beyond just being friendly and having friends.
Mm-hmm.
But Japan seems to have hundreds of these words, which makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, and so complicated, right? Yeah. If you don't understand the language, then it's really difficult to decipher the concept, you know. And just in Portuguese, that word saudade is kind of, you know, one example that came up, but it's, you know, yeah, it is the same. And then obviously the last one, social, right? Mm. Bonding with community, which is number one, super important, I would say, in Japanese culture, the idea. And this is, I mean, obviously I am generalizing because there are other participants, for example, in my study, they were quite individuals and they have very, you know, individual and self-centered ikigais. But generally, the sense of community, the sense of giving to the other, following the other, and being in line with the other, not really disturbing, you know, the flinky of things. Just keep it there.
Is that similar to Gordon Matthews' Itaikan, sense of unity?
Yeah. I would say so. Yeah, absolutely.
So I have a question then. Is there the difference between others and social? Because others, you've given examples of family and friends, and then social is bonding with community. So is social broader?
Yeah, I think social is more about your work environment. Yeah, you're giving back to the community. And others, it might be more related to interpersonal relationships. So the people that are your close people, right? Your friends, your family, your partners. So I think that's where the distinction is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense because I often describe ikigai as intimacy. You can have this intellectual intimacy or spiritual or creative or emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe the social aspect where it's broader and involves community and contribution is where people find that sense of purpose.
Yeah, and it's also about work, right? I think the social, you know, it's about your work. It's about some participants define themselves or define their ikigai as their work, not just their work. But I had participants who told me, well, a big component of my ikigai is my work.
I definitely can relate. It's definitely my ikigai to research and do these interviews and share what I learned. And my father-in-law, who's Japanese, he's a master potter and he's early 80s and still makes pottery and he's retired. His sons have taken over the family business, but yeah, this intrinsic value or motivation to the work that he does. And he's done it for, you know, I think over close to 60 years. And he just still keeps going because he finds meaning and purpose and just connects to the work he does.
Well, embodies pottery, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He certainly does. Actually, yeah. So I'm quite envious of you. You've had this really what I imagine to be fascinating, intimate experience of interviewing 23 Japanese women between the ages of 25 and 72. So you've probably had this broad perspective, and you did that over 7 months. So from July 2022 to January this year for data collection. But it must have been insightful and intriguing to have these, you know, intimate conversations, or maybe I'm making an assumption, maybe they weren't always intimate, but discussing ikigai and what makes life worth living. So was that something you enjoyed, and did you look forward to those conversations?
I was quite nervous, to be honest, at the beginning. I was quite nervous because you go and talk to someone and say, hello, how you do? What is your life mission? So it's quite, you know, intrusive. and you know, Japanese people by nature are quite shy.
Yes.
So it requires some master skills of me to to let women open themselves. So I think what led for them to talk about ikigai was the other question, which we can talk about at some other time. What kind of crisis have you had in your life, and how did you lose your ikigai, and what does ikigai mean to you? So I did enjoy, and just to correct you, I did interview to 23 Japanese women, but I did more. So those were kind of like the formal interviews. But I just talked to everyone. I mean, everyone, my colleagues, the neighbors, I mean, you name it, the lady at the supermarket, it doesn't matter. I talked to everyone. I really wanted to have a broad idea of what Japanese people think about what is ikigai. So yes, in that sense, was really enjoyable, you know, very, very enjoyable. Yeah.
It's funny, when I've asked people, especially Japanese people I don't really know, that they're surprised I know the word, and some instantly know and some don't, or that they definitely need time, and often a stock answer, I think, for people who don't know, especially fathers, is, oh, you know, my family or my children. But I remember one person gave me a really interesting answer, and he said camping with my friends.
Yeah,
it was really specific, and you can imagine this man busy working, and then he really looks forward to these trips where he goes out in nature and camps and forgets about life and has a good time. Yeah, these conversations must have been fascinating, because you probably didn't know how people would respond.
I think, you know, the most interesting for me was some women were quite direct, and they said, ikigai, what do you mean by ikigai? And others actually confronted me with another challenging question, asked, do I need ikigai in my life to live a good life? I had a really funny answer from a young participant, and she just burst off laughing, and she told me, I am so sorry, I am so embarrassed, but the first time I heard ikigai was when I was in India. And my Indian yoga teacher came with a book and told me, look, this is Japan, this is ikigai. And I remember looking at her thinking, what is she talking about?
Yes, the Western perception, or the perception outside of Japan's a bit distorted.
So I thought, how fascinating. And, you know, these really powerful answers remind you that ikigai is not, you know, an homogeneous concept. Neither is Japan an homogeneous society. You have different groups of Japanese people. Demographically, they are different. Accents change. Economic situation between prefectures change. So we should remember ourselves that Japan is not an homogeneous society, as much as they might want to think of. But, you know, you have a series of Brazilian Japanese and Korean Japanese and second and third generations, and not even going to touch, you know, Okinawa Prefecture, because that's a completely all different story that, you know, it's something that we don't need to discuss here. But to give you the idea that Japan is not an homogeneous society, neither is ikigai.
I agree, and I've learned that. I think people do have that perception. Maybe they have that perception because it's not as multicultural as other countries, But yeah, we could go off on a tangent. So let's go back to these conversations and what you discovered. And you present quite a few short case studies of people's answers. So what were ones that inspired you or that you found unusual? And how did they describe the experience of feeling ikigai in the body?
I gave my participants fake names, obviously, for anonymity. So, you know, we can just speak about them as with their fake names. I had really interesting descriptions. So Kiko-san, she was in her 60s. She also had a car accident. She had a trauma in the brain. And she told me that at the time some of her friends advised her to go to Nikon therapy. And she told me, I went to Nikon therapy, but it wasn't for me. So she told me, well, ikigai then, you know, ikigai is when I'm walking in the mountains and I feel that internal vibration in my chest. So, you know, I wanted to know, so I would, you know, keep asking, well, the internal vibration, where is that internal vibration? You know, which part of the body? And she was going, mune. So, you know, my chest. And I thought, that's really interesting. Tina-san was a Brazilian Japanese. And she was born and raised in Japan, but she had a Brazilian ancestry. And she kept telling me that Ikigai was God and connecting with God and nature. And she also alludes to that idea of vibration, strong emotion. She even said to me, well, when I was younger, I thought going to parties and dancing and having that loud music, that would be my ikigai. But now that I got older, I understood that ikigai is about, you know, connecting with God and connecting with nature. Ewa-san, she recalls back to the cognitive, you know, dimension of ikigai, right? These, so while Kiko-san and Tina-san might recall, a strong emotional dimension, the emotions or, you know, the feelings of what happens, Ewa talks about, again, the feeling of being in contact with nature, but it's about calmness, about reaching a state of calm. So it's about reaching a state of mind, right? The state of calmness. And Mona-san was a really interesting participant. She was a graphic designer and musician, and she was a bit of an activist. She was the most, you know, colorful of my participants. And she used a word that I didn't know in Japanese that I actually had to ask. And, you know, my Japanese is not completely fluent and there are words that I absolutely don't know. And she used this word, uneri. And I didn't know what uneri was. So I researched and it was like swell, like waves, you know, the swelling of waves. And that's how she described. So she used her imagination describing ikigai as a warm feeling or a feeling of, you know, the ocean and the waves and that swell.
Yeah, I didn't know that word either. So it's fascinating how it is subjective and the terms they use is unique to each person. And calmness to swell to vibration. It's really fascinating.
And then, you know, another participant spoke more of ikigai in terms of social context. And that's where, you know, my dimension of sociality and others comes. So Kari-san was a librarian and she had a realization of ikigai through the trauma, through, you know, her stressful experience. She had this realizing of what a ikigai was. And she felt there was support others. And that supporting of other people was a nice feeling that took away of her anxiety. So by recognizing her ikigai, which was in relation to the other, then her mental state or state of being comes to a calmer state. So one thing relates to the other.
That's interesting because, and I'm sure that hopefully there'll be more research on this, but when I spoke to Dr. Dean Fido on the Ikigai 9, which you cite in your paper.
Yeah.
And from the very brief, I think, study or research he had access to, there was this idea that perhaps ikigai could help with depression, but not anxiety. And it we can probably say, well, that maybe not be quite accurate now if it helped Kari with her anxiety.
But it's a circular, right? If you recognize your ikigai and then the action.
Yeah.
The action of recognizing, which is helping others, it's the action of helping others that reduces the anxiety. So you have like, a circle. I have realization of ikigai, which is helping others, which the helping others, the process of helping others, then reduces anxiety.
Yeah.
And this circles back to ikigai, right?
Well, that's what I thought. I thought if you're anxious, I mean, everyone gets anxious. You can't stop anxiety. If you do something for the first time, you just mentioned how when you had these interviews, initially you were a bit nervous, and so I'm sure you felt anxiety. But, yeah, once you tap into your ikigai, I guess the anxiety sort of fades away and you forget about it.
I had a really interesting, I think, you don't have favorites, right? But she was definitely a very interesting Japanese woman, Sara-san. She was a writer, and she had a really interesting life. And she was a bit of a cosmopolitan because, she had an uprising different from the other participants. Okay. She lived in France. So interesting, we had our interview, like half French, half Japanese. And Sarah said something really interesting. Sara-san said, it's the love between human beings. But she told me, she used the word rigai. So the word of rigai. It's not rigai. It's not about the benefits of, being in a marriage relationship or mother and child. It's not about that rigai or amae. It's much more about just relationship with human beings and the love between, human beings. And that was ikigai. And it was really surprising because I came with the assumption, because she was a writer, I thought, well, ikigai is writing. And she's quite a famous writer. She wrote quite a lot of things. So, I can't really reveal who she is, but okay. her books are out there. So I thought, well, ikigai is that. And, she gave me a really fascinating answer. It's the love between human beings. And, it's this connection to others, right? So it's the connection to society or the connection between people. It's ikigai, it's about interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, that one stood out for me, actually. And when I read that, I thought, wow, this person's being very honest or very transparent, because some people might think, oh, I really should say it's my wife or my husband or my children. Mm-hmm. And she was very clear about that, wasn't she? She's saying, I'm not saying love between perhaps your closest people. It's this general love between human being or all people. And I thought that was interesting for sure. Mm.
And then, in contrast to Sarah, you have Yuko-san, who was, a 72-year-old lady, tells you that her ikigai were a children, but ikigai has changed. And this comes, to what Mieko Kamiya also talks about, this transformative process of ikigai, that ikigai is temporal. Mm. Right? It's not temporal. It just evolves. And for Yuko, she had an interesting story, which we will talk about at some other time, about it, all of these women and their traumatic experiences. But she told me that her ikigai developed from first the sense of mission, Shimeikan, having the sense of mission,
yes,
which was to take care of her children. But now that she became older, the ikigai was just singing with the community group. So she used the expression, my ikigai is much more soft now. So it's really interesting how people use their imagination to express ikigai. You never think about ikigai as the quality of softness. Mm. And she gave a quality to ikigai, which was the quality of softness.
I mean, that speaks to me very much Japanese. Japanese do seem to identify the small or the soft. And even Shimeikan, that context for her, Shimeikan was her children. I think if you mention, hey, what's your purpose, or what gives you a sense of purpose to people in the West, it has to be something quite ambitious or life-changing. Mm. So I love that as well, that Japanese seem to find purpose in perhaps, in the small, but, what could be more important than being a parent? Probably nothing. Being a parent is important. You're guiding and shaping someone who will hopefully contribute to the world. So that is a really strong source of ikigai and would come with that sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been an enjoyable conversation.
Then you had others, you know, again on the societal part, like Yui-san. She had a really nice metaphor for ikigai. She said, you know, ikigai was like eating sushi, you know, sharing the sushi with other people. You know, minasan sushi wo taberu. So please eat your sushi. And she even said, well, I don't have to eat the sushi. I can just watch other people. And that already makes me happy. So, you know, this connection of, again, it's fascinating how people will describe the ikigai through internal vibrations, children, human beings, you know, supporting others, sushi. I mean, you wouldn't imagine, right? So for me, the whole experience was really rich and really eye-opening.
Yeah, that answer about sharing sushi was interesting, as in, for it almost suggested or hinted that for her it's this collective experience. Mm. When often we describe ikigai as something, you know, very individualistic and personal, and for some Japanese, you know, private, they might not even want to talk about it. But yeah, your point that how they describe it and use different words or ways to say, oh, it's this vibration or it's eating sushi. that is fascinating. So it ties in all these things, feelings, emotions, and these sensations that arise through their bodies. And some said, yeah, mune, you know, or I think one said in her belly, and she circled her belly.
Yeah, the school teacher, yes, she said it was like butterflies in her belly. So. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's always associated with some sort of shaking, you know, some sort of like, yeah, it definitely has a quality of movement.
Mm.
That's what ikigai is about. It has this quality of moving from within.
Yeah, I was actually reflecting on this, and if I had to describe what it feels like in the body, for me it's almost, I mean, my ikigai seems to excite me, and I get excited and I have this kind of build-up of energy, and it's almost as if I'm Superman, I'm about to take flight. That's how it kind of feels. So I have this, I don't know, I might clap my hands or go, yeah, or... So for me, it's quite, there's a lot of energy. It's very positive. And I have this desire to share it with my friends and my wife. And I think my wife's very, very sick of me talking about ikigai or these ikigai moments I have. But yeah, it seems to quickly recharge me. I seem to feel it everywhere. I want to stand up and, let the ikigai out, let the ikigai energy out. So there's actually a quote I'd like to share, and I was wondering if you'd like to read it since you wrote it or...
Okay, yeah, sure. The way I see it, ikigai is a body and mind experience that occurs when participants reflect on it and connect it with certain aspects of their lives. The body is both a natural pre-reflective self and an important medium for reflexivity. Therefore, thinking, perceiving, imagining, and feeling ikigai experience are all parts of body knowledge. If we are to study phenomena like ikigai and its experience, we need to place the body at its center, because this experience comes from people's perceptions, orientation, and engagement with the world, and requires body knowledge to embody and make sense of itself and its interrelated dimensions.
There you go. So that was, yeah, that really stood out for me. And it's like, oh, this is all coming together. And in short, I came to mind that we're talking about bodily awareness as a guide to understanding our ikigai sources. So if people said, oh, I don't know what my ikigai is, you could probably spend the next week or so, whenever you're doing an activity, what's your body communicating? Is it saying it's good? Is it saying it's exciting? Do you feel calm or soft? All these descriptions your interviewees gave. So, yeah, bodily awareness. Am I on the right track?
You are on the right track. I mean, let's say exactly what you said. So we take a moment to reflect on this lived experience of Ikigai. And let's establish just for now that Ikigai is well-being, right? It's about flourishing in life and it's about our well-being. So you just did it now, right? You thought about it, you verbalize it. And you even, you know, I can see you, so you actually moved it. You made the movement of flying, of standing up, of, you know, movement. So you expressed that inner feeling outwards. I think when you do that, you become more aware of your somatic self, you know, this idea of body and mind relation. So in other words, what you just did and, you know, what I do or my participant. So when we connect with our bodily sensations to the meaning that we give to Ikigai, then we have body awareness. Then we have awareness, more awareness of ourselves. And we can all do this, right? So this awareness that we then gain can lead to interpretations, imaginations, and meaning construction. So in other words, when you let your body take over, you can tune into yourself and you can tune into the body as the main channel for representations of life meaning or these feelings that arise from having a purpose in life, whatever that purpose is, right? And whatever that feeling is, if it's an internal vibration or an explosion or a moment of calmness, or if it's just thinking that it's like eating sushi. You know, it's that moment of awareness of your body and mind connection and your presence in the world.
This highlights the importance that we should spend more time to be more reflective. And I think in this modern age where we're often distracted with phones and social media and, you know, now it's so affordable to access entertainment. You can just be on YouTube all day. So if we are encouraging people to reflect on not only what your Ikigai sources are, but also how that feels to you in the body and also perhaps emotionally, do you have any suggestions for a reflective process?
Well, when I was a dance lecturer, I did a lot of somatic practices with my students and then, you know, with clients with traumatic experiences. So I would say, I'm actually going to give you the answer of one of my participants.
Okay.
She actually said to me, get to know yourself a little bit better. It was fantastic.
Nice.
So get to know yourself. So I'm going to expand on it. Understand your essence, the things that you like and the things that you dislike. Be curious to understand your traits, your personality traits, and don't suppress the bad traits. Let them be. They're part of who you are.
Yeah.
So explore these things. Explore them. Go deep into why are they there. And I would say write them, sing them, dance them, paint them, you know, put them out and share them. Share them with your friends. Share with the people that know you. I don't think, you know, you can just know yourself by just being with yourself. Because we, as humans, we are reflections of one another's, right? We're all going to share moments where we all had pain or sadness or grief or happiness or excitement or joy. The way we feel those things obviously are different, but we can all, to a certain extent, recognize those things. So I think a good way of, you know, knowing myself, it's always as well to ask my friends for their critical opinion. You know, how do they see? How do they see my actions? It's not about being judgmental. It's like being a review on a journal paper. Do your comments. You know, read it from a neutral position and just do your side comments and help me to improve my paper. So I think, you know, we all need each other to improve each other. But ultimately, let's start with ourselves, yeah, with getting to know ourselves.
Well, that's an interesting idea to write or draw or sing or dance your thoughts, which hints perhaps this give expression to who you are. That's actually how Camus and Mirkon define self-actualization, to use your unique imagination to express or create something new. And I guess we are our authentic self when we are lost in writing or drawing or singing. We are expressing who we are. And so if we have people critique that and we're open to feedback or even just critique who we are, you know, how am I as a person? Be honest, if we're open to that feedback, it would be very helpful. Is that that's quite related to, is it Nikon or?
Yeah, it could be Nikon, where you spend your time in introspection, right? And the other did for you good and what did you did good for that person?
Yeah.
And then, you know, come to a place where the therapist comes and talk to you, but essentially just very minimal talk and you go back into this reflection.
It's very much self-reflection and you verbalize it to a total stranger.
Yeah, but I think that's important, right? I mean, I usually, if I do have something in my life that I don't know how to fix or it's really bothering me, I want opinions from people who know me or sometimes people who don't know me so they can be more neutral.
Yeah.
And, you know, different opinions help. I think having an eye from outside helps you to be better and observe other people, helps you to observe yourself as well. I think as my work as an anthropologist, one of the things that we do as anthropologists is observe people, right? And I think by observing others and observe other people's behaviors and the way they see the world and they construct the world, you learn about your own world. You learn how to challenge your biases, how to debunk your biases, how to be more inclusive, more diverse, to open your horizons. And also, you know, to get out of your comfort zone. Not all my friends tell me, you know, you're doing the right thing. It also takes bravery for the people that know you well and say, you're not doing the right thing. And I think I value that a lot. Not just the ones that say, well, I support you fully in what you're doing. Well, actually, I don't support you because I think, you know, this might be dangerous or this might lead to A, B, and C. And then all of a sudden, you start seeing things from a different perspective. You know, and those opinions, you have to cherish these opinions and you have to embrace them and be humble enough to say, well, you know what, maybe, you know, the way I'm stubborn in doing things or, you know, my way of thinking or my way of seeing this problem, let's see what this person, you know, this is quite a contribution. So thank you. But that takes guts, right?
Yeah, I was going to say it takes vulnerability on your part, yeah, but honesty and, yeah, I mean, a lot of friends, maybe they've out of discomfort or care and won't, maybe they're not going to be fully honest. So there's that vulnerability on your part to, hey, I want you to be, you know, critique this or tell me what you think I am or who I am. And hopefully you do have friends who will be honest to say, this is good, but what you're doing here, I don't think it's you or it doesn't seem to align to your values or I'm not sure why you're doing it, you know, why are you doing this? That's a good friend, yeah? That's a friend you can trust.
I mean, because we all need mentors in life, right? Our school mentors, our, you know, club mentors, our friends, our mentors, our partners, our mentors, they are our masters and we are all masters for each other.
Yeah, so this is what's amazing. All these conversations I have reveals these ideas or thoughts or things I've never considered or don't really practice. And so I think one thing I've learnt from you today is we should take care of our bodies and try to be in more tune. And I guess exercising and eating well and going out in nature would be beneficial. But also this idea of get yourself critiqued. Or the work you're doing or whatever you're doing, critique by people who will be honest to tell you. That's really interesting.
And also, again, think about your ikigai, right? Your ikigai is going to give you clues of the type of person you are, the things that you like and the things that you don't like. So your sources of Ikigai, you know, are also, you know, tell you a lot of who you are, right?
Well, with that being said, Jamila, what is your Ikigai, or what is one of your strongest sources of Ikigai?
Yes, Nick. So I think you are an anthropologist. You know, you just turned into an anthropologist making these questions. It is complicated. I'm going to use the word alchemy.
That's how it feels, yeah, or that's what it is.
I think Ikigai is about alchemy. It's about, you know, transformation. It's about helping others, helping other people heal. It's about sharing my thoughts and contributing to society.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's a fascinating answer. That threw me a little bit, alchemy, but being part of change or making something grow.
Be part of change and make change. I think my Ikigai is about bringing the pieces of the puzzle together. I take a lot of joy when I bring people together. You know,
I do
and
too, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I take, you know, a lot of joy. I think it's part of my Ikigai seeing things work thanks to my hard work. So I like that. I really like that.
How do you feel that in the body? That's what we've talked about so much today. So, yeah.
Self-realization, vibration. I think it's about vibration. It's about something that becomes bigger than my body. So I feel it from the outside. I feel that comes from the inside to the outside. Think about, you know, I'm going to use now my imagination, and I think about Ikigai as light. As light, as driving force, as wind, you know, it's very from the elements. You know, it's like water. I love the ocean. I'm a swimmer. I dive. So I find my Ikigai in that element, in the element of water, in the element of finding that I'm just a tiny little thing in the bigger picture. And that is just amazing, this sense of being humble, you know.
Sense of small self in a...
Yes, in the big self.
In nature or the big world or the collective. Yeah, there's definitely that feeling of you're moving forward as well. Like you just feel your life or your body, or there's this energy moving you forward when you're experiencing Ikigai, but even when you just talk about, sort of drives you forward. So it's a fascinating subject, and I would love to explore this crisis aspect.
Sure.
So I'd definitely love to have you back on. So I think when I've read your second paper, which I think is about that aspect of how do we handle crisis, and Ikigai might be an answer, let's do another podcast.
Let's do it.
So thank you so much for your time today and for
thank
all this
you so
work you're putting into the research. And it's fascinating. We're seeing so much collective knowledge coming together, research in all these different niches. And I recently did Ikigai in relation to robotics, and can there be an AI-enhanced robot that could help people find or remind people of their Ikigai sources? Yeah, Ikigai in crisis, or to embodying, or the embodiment of Ikigai. So it's fascinating. How can people find you and reach out to you, Jamila?
Well, that's an interesting question. my name, if you Google my name, you will find me at the website of the university where I'm currently in. So you can reach out via Twitter as well, which, you know, has the details, and my email is there. So if people want to find me, I think the best way to find me now is through the Marine Climate Change Unit, which is led by Professor Tim Ravazzi, a wonderful man doing incredibly work on climate change. And you will see my name on his unit page with my contact and with my Twitter account, so people can reach out to me that way. Sure. And check out his page and check out, you know, the amazing work that he's doing and his unit is doing. Yeah.
So we'll put a link to that on the show notes. Actually, I mean, your name comes up on a lot of research websites and...
yeah, because of my dancing days, maybe as well, you know, you will see a lot of pictures of me doing strange things.
So you probably need to get a personal website going at some stage.
So. Yeah.
Awesome. Jamila, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you. I look forward to our next conversation.
Sure. Thank you so much, Nick. Yeah.
My pleasure. Bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.